Hello everyone and welcome back to another one of my gramophone shows, and I hope that you've been passing on the link to the Erlokin gramophone show to all your friends so that everybody can, as it were, virtually go around my record collection and listen to the fantastic music which is lying half forgotten on 78 RPM record shelves because so many people don't seem to know about anything that was recorded before 1960. Well, today I'm going to start with a gentleman called Mario Ancona. I heard about him again recently, I've always known about him of course, when I went to a lecture about Jewish opera singers who sang at the Metropolitan Opera in New York and Chicago, and this gentleman certainly did. Apparently, and I learnt this during the lecture, it was quite common, just as Jewish people in Germany named themselves after what they did for a living, such as Goldschmidt or Schneider, jobs in other words, the Jewish people of Italy tended to name themselves after the town in which they live. Therefore, Mario was named after Ancona, the place where his family must have lived for generations. He must have come from a pretty well-off family because before he decided to become a singer, he'd studied, medicine, law, art, all sorts of things. And in fact, he only trained to be a singer in his 20s, fairly late for a singer, particularly in those days. But within 2 years of his debut, was chosen by Leoncavallo to play the pivotal role of Silvio in his brand new opera, short opera, called Pagliacci. Why the role is... Mario Ancona was born almost a generation before Caruso in 1860, yet did make at least one recording with the great tenor, their version of the classic duet from the Paul Fischers, Au fond du temple saint, but in Italian, of course. Strange recording because everything goes out of tune at the end. I think that the machine, as it were, the spring and the machine had gone down. The very, very last phrase, everybody's out of tune, and I've tried to correct that when I listen to it by doing things digitally to it. But to return to the subject, Ancona must have been one of the top baritones of the time because he was very much, how can I put this, one of the baritones of the establishment. The most famous one of all of that time would have been Battistini. I personally think he sang much better than Battistini. He didn't sing sharp at the top. He had more rich sound at the bottom. I have a feeling that had he lived to make electrical recordings, we would have heard just how vibrant and exciting his voice really was. I don't think that the acoustic method did his voice any favours. Tita Ruffo, that great baritone, said that when he met him, he found him rather snobbish and so forth. But of course, he was a good 18 years older than Ruffo, and may have disregarded him as a young upstart at the time. Certainly, Ancona was very happy mixing with the very best of society and the best of singers, because he hung around with people like Fernando de Lucia, one of the greatest tenors of his generation, and maybe the greatest soprano of, if not all time, certainly of her own time, Adelina Patti. Those are the people with whom he sang, and he was very much the establishment singer of his day. So, did his voice live up to what came later? I think it did. So, please now listen to his 1907 recording of the prologue to Pagliacci, recorded with a very crude early orchestra, but nevertheless with some sort of orchestra. He did make an earlier recording, and I hope that you'll enjoy this as much as I do. The great baritone, if now perhaps an obscure name, Mario Ancona. I should perhaps add two things. First of all, that aria, the prologue, is not sung by Silvio, the character Silvio. It's sung by the other baritone part in Pagliacci. So Mario Ancona would not have sung that in the premiere of the opera. And secondly, I was just looking at his dates. He was born in 1861 and died 1931 or 1860. In other words, he was almost exactly contemporary with Dame Nellie Melba, and after Adelina Patti, he sang with her quite regularly. So that was, again, the normal mixing of the sort of singers he would find himself with, the very, very top echelon of the golden era of opera singing, as it was often regarded. The next gentleman you're going to hear is anything but obscure, possibly the most famous man there's ever been, certainly close to it, even now, and that's, what, 86 years after this next record was made. Probably the most famous film star of all time, I always say so. He's my particular favourite, and his name was Charles Spencer Chaplin. I think he's probably, even today, more famous than the Beatles and Elvis Presley put together, because everybody's heard of him, whether they're 9 or 90, whether they're in Great Britain or China, or maybe halfway across Antarctica, who knows, maybe the penguins know about him. Well, apart from all the things that he's famous for, he also played left-handed violin, a bit of piano, and wrote the odd song or two. Later on, his songs are pretty good. Things like Smile, which went with his film Modern Times, or Eternally, which went with one of his later films. However, back in the 20s, he must have made friends with a band leader called Abe Lyman, and he obviously wanted to try out one or two of his dance tunes. And obviously, when it's that famous a celebrity, you say, fine, come along, wave the stick in front of my band. My guess is that Abe Lyman did the arrangements, and there's a wonderful picture of the recording being made, one which I'll try and put up if you're accessing this podcast through my own website. You'll see a little slideshow, and this should be one of the pictures, because this is recorded with this, what, 10-piece orchestra, whatever it was, a few months, sadly, before the microphone came into a studio, and you can see how they were all grouped around the conductor, standing on a tall bar stool, and you can actually see the recording hall, and you can see how this was made. So when you're listening to this record, you can actually see what it looked like the day they made it, which is fascinating. It's a very strange title to a rather strange dance tune, not really Chaplin at his best. Nevertheless, it's called With You Dear in Bombay, and the opening verse is the sort of music that you can imagine being played as the background to one of Chaplin's silent films. The main tune less so, and it's less inspired and less exciting, but something about the verse which you immediately imagine to be the accompanying music to a silent film, at least I do. Be that as it may, this is 1925, this is the Abe Lyman Band, this is Charles Chaplin conducting his own song, and for your delectation and pleasure, here it is, after all these years, quite a rare track. Charles Chaplin as band leader. I recently met his granddaughter, who's making some sort of career for herself, as indeed a film actress here in England, back where he was born. I don't really know her yet. Let's see if we get to be friends. If so, I'll play her that track, because I bet she's never heard it. Well, somebody I did know for 20-odd years, and I've played some recordings of before, was the wonderful Adelaide Hall, one of the first of the great jazz singers. By the early 30s, she was a really huge star in New York, well, in the USA. So much so that on this record, when she's being accompanied by the Duke Ellington Orchestra, it is indeed her name that comes up first with the Duke Ellington Orchestra, rather than the vocal chorus sung by. That's how big a star she was back then. Indeed, Duke hadn't been to Great Britain yet. He hadn't quite realised how important he was when this record was made on the 7th of January 1933. It is one of the two songs, or one of the two or three or four songs, that Addie sang in the Blackbirds show that made her famous three or four years earlier. And I'm playing this for a particular reason, but remember once more that it's her name on the label that comes up as the star of this recording. I like it particularly because in the middle you hear a little bit of the verse where they've got to speed up a bit to get the whole thing on the 3 minutes. And at that point, the band isn't arranged and it's just Addy accompanied by Duke Ellington on piano. I love this track, and it's the way we remember Adelaide Hall as the star of Blackbirds, the Cotton Club, and for her recordings that she made with Duke Ellington, the first of which was, of course, Creole Love Call, where she's credited with recording the first ever wordless vocal, scat vocal, if you will. Here she is, a few years later, even better, I think, singing one of those great songs, I Must Have That Man.
Much caring just where I will end. Oh, but I must have that man. I'm like an oven that's crying for heat. He treats me awful each time that we meet. It's just unlawful how that boy can cheat. Oh, but I must have that man. He's hot as Hades, a lady not safe in his arms when she's kissed. But I'm afraid that he's cooled off. Maybe I'm rude off his list. Oh, I'll never be missed. I need that person much worse than just bad. I'm half alive and he's driving me mad. He's only human if he's to be had. I must have that man. I'm so unhappy, left all alone. Ain't got nobody to love now. The man I long for is not so strong for me. He's not an angel, but I don't care. Perhaps a change will come someday. Whatever he is, I want to be his wife. That's why I cry every day.
Adelaide Hall, my friend, it can't be 20 years since I last saw her, but it almost is. She died in 1993. Dear friend and a wonderful artist. But there's a reason why I include that track on this particular podcast, as you will understand later on. In the meantime, let's go back to 1877, where in Turin, in Italy, on the 12th of June, was born one of the great French bass baritones. The reason that that's true is because he had French parents, and after studying law, he made his debut at the age of 22 in Bayonne in a small part, and he had a long career wherein he was known not only as a great singer but also as a great singing actor. Possibly he wasn't as great in that role as someone like Fyodor Shalyapin, but then who was? But he still was a great actor in a very, very French manner. His mode of singing was absolutely French from one end of his body to the other, no matter that he was born in Italy or might have had Italian blood somewhere in him. He was a French singer. He fascinates me particularly because he was a bass baritone. He was basically a bass, although he had a high enough range to sing the odd baritone role. I too am a bass, and I, like him, have a very high timbre. Neither of us sound like deep rich basses like so many bass singers do. And so it just made me think maybe one day I will just record an odd operatic aria, because normally I think, oh, I've got a bass voice but the sound of a tenor, that's no good. Vanni Marcou is the only person I listen to that gives me hope. Well, as I say, he had a long career. He died in Paris in 1962, which meant he lived for a pretty long time. What is that, 85? And he was particularly known for the sort of roles where the acting was important. And I suppose nothing could be more important than the role of Hamlet. In this case, not the play, but the opera based on Shakespeare's play, written by Ambroise Thomas, the great French operatic composer. Now, I know this aria is sung in Italian by the great Tita Ruffo, but in a way, this version is even better. It's in the right language to begin with, and the acting is superb, so I highly recommend it to you. This was recorded in 1931, when he would have been in his mid to late 50s, and this shows Jean-Émile Vanni Marcou, which was his full name, at his very best. He tended to be known just by his surname, Vanni Marcou, but that was his full name. Here is then Hamlet's soliloquy in French as Être ou ne pas être, recorded in 1931. Wonderful. Jean-Émile Vanimarcoux, wonderful singer, largely forgotten these days. And that really is why I started doing this series of podcasts, because if you get a vote in the paper about the best 100 films in the last century, you find that the vast majority of films voted for will be in the last 10 years, never mind 100 years. And the same thing goes when you talk about music. People say, oh, I listen to everything, and then you find out that they actually listen to a range of pop music made over the last 30, or if you're lucky, 40 years. Nobody seems to know about anything recorded or performed before 1960, and my contention is that you'll find greater performers before that than after that. That having been said, about 3 or 4 years ago, on one of the Academy Award or Oscar evenings, they had a lineup of all the surviving winners of Oscars. The stage was absolutely packed full of people, mostly youngsters, mostly famous stars of today, maybe a few middle-aged ones. But there in one corner, with a wonderful smile, was the oldest of them all. Her name was and is Louise Reiner, because I'm delighted to say that she's still seems to be alive at the age of 101. I gather she lives in London. She was born in Dusseldorf, but largely brought up in Vienna, and because of the way she could act, she was often known as the Viennese teardrop. Irving Thalberg, the sort of boy genius of the time, as they called him, was one of the people behind her being cast in films in America, having been in various German-speaking films in Europe. And in The Great Ziegfeld, in a fairly small role as the estranged wife of Ziegfeld, and a year later in an amazing film about medieval China. Can you imagine them making a film about medieval China now? And starring with the equally wonderful Paul Muni, she gained 2 Oscars in 2 years. Irving Thalberg died soon afterwards, and they didn't obviously know quite what to do with her, because her career then floundered and never really recovered, although I gather she was continuing to act right until her late 80s. She's now retired and apparently living happily somewhere in London, as I say. Well, the record I've got here, I don't know what it was. It's a single-sided 78. I assume it was for use on the radio. It's got a sort of special label with a picture of her on it. It can't be a record for publicising The Great Ziegfeld, because the man at the beginning says that she's won 2 Oscars, which means that this was made at least a year after the release of that film, because he couldn't have known about the 2nd Oscar until after 1937, because that was when the film about ancient China, The Good Earth, was made. So, as I say, I don't know quite what this record was made for. Well, I'll let the American announcer, the typical American announcer of the time with the authoritative voice, I'll let him tell you about this scene. The scene, by the way, which I'm sure was the one which really won Louise Reiner her 1st Oscar. I just wanted to add this. He mentions Billie Burke, and she not only was a real actress, but she was still working for MGM at this time. She, in fact, was the Good Fairy, for instance, a few years later in The Wizard of Oz. But for some reason or other, she doesn't play herself in The Great Ziegfeld. They have Myrna Loy do it. I don't know quite why that was. The part of Ziegfeld himself, however, was given to William Powell. Well, that's all I need to tell you, except here is Louise Reiner, and she's wonderful in this scene. No wonder she won her Oscar.
Presenting Louise Reiner, twice winner of the Academy Award, as Anna Held in the famous Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer picture, The Great Ziegfeld. Poignantly aching heart of Anna Held is breaking as she realizes her former husband, Florence Ziegfeld, has married the lovely Billie Burke. Bewildered, she speaks to her maid, Marie.
Oh, Marie, I'm too tired to go anywhere and do anything. Look at the paper. Tell me, where did they go on their honeymoon? But they could not go anywhere, Marie. Miss Borg is appearing in a play here. We saw her only 2 weeks ago. She's a lovely actress, Marie. Wait. She has such twinkling eyes and... Marie, call his office. I will congratulate him. I should wish him luck. Wait. No, no. No, I cannot speak to him now. No, I'm so much inside. here. He's on the telephone. Oh. Hello, Flo. Yes, this is Anna. I could not help it, calling you, congratulating you. How I am? Oh, wonderful. Hello. Never better in my whole life. I'm so excited about my new plans. I'm going to Paris, yes, for a few weeks, and then I can get back, and then I'm doing a new show, and I... Oh, oui, yes, oui, it's all so wonderful, and I'm so happy, and yes, I hope you are happy too, yes. I'm so glad for you. Yes, Flo. Count 24 ex-husbands and ex-wives to tell each other how happy they are. Oui, Flo. Yes. Goodbye, Flo.
The then 26-year-old Louise Reiner, wonderful acting, and of course not in her native language. She's now 101. To go back to my old friend Adelaide Hall, who also performed right up to the age of 90, she was a wonderful person to be with. She had no desire to be treated like a diva. She loved to perform. If somebody could just pick her up and take her to the gig, if there could be maybe a bottle of wine backstage, and maybe a vase of flowers, and some adoring fans after the show, that's all she ever wanted out of life. The only time I ever felt there was a slight bristling in her attitude to anything was when the name Elizabeth Welch was mentioned. Some people confused the two of them. They were nothing really like one another to look at, but nevertheless, they were both American black performers who lived in Great Britain. I think the problem was that Addie knew that she'd been a major star in the USA in the late 20s when Elizabeth Welch was still in the chorus. And it annoyed her, I think, that anybody should confuse the two of them. And this is really true. The books say that Elizabeth Welch was born in 1904, although my other great friend Benny Carter was convinced that she was older than that. We'll never know. She died only in 2003, so she lived to 99, and she was still singing very well in her 90s. I remember she was in a TV production here where she sang Stormy Weather and was in very good voice even then. Her career took longer to take off. Her first performance in the chorus was just a year after Addie's in 1922 in another black revue. She was, in fact, of mixed parentage. She was part black, part Native American, and on her other side, she was Scottish, with her parents originally going all the way back to Irish descent, which, considering her surname was Welsh, is all very confusing, really. Anyhow, she continued to play small parts in these reviews during the Harlem Renaissance, one assumes, in the 20s. And in Blackbirds of 28, when Addie was the big star, she must have been in the chorus. Later on, she moved to Paris, was discovered there by Cole Porter, put in his musical Nymph Errant in London, where, again, Ivor Novello saw her. Again, this helped her career, and she was in films with Paul Robeson. And in general, whereas Addie's major career had been in America, and never quite was regained in England, Elizabeth Welch's career was in England, or in Europe at any rate, but mainly in England. And so, possibly, Elizabeth was better known in England in the later years than Addie was, and I'm sure this rankled. Be that as it may, back in 1928, she was just a member of the chorus, so when she sang a couple of songs from Blackbirds, of which we've already heard one sung by Addie, her name was certainly not put above that of the band. This was a band of mainly white musicians working under the title of Irving Mills' Hotsy Totsy Gang. Very fine musicians, including Eddie Lang on guitar, by the way. And on this label, it just says Vocal Refrain by Elizabeth Welsh. She was not a big star at that time. I'm sure that's the reason that Addie used to get, not angry, but you could just see her stiffen when anybody confused the two of them. Be that as it may, Elizabeth Welsh was also a fine artist, and this is her version of one of the hits from that show in 1928, recorded that very year, and it's called Doing the New Lowdown. It was originally a feature for Bojangles in that musical, but here it is, done obviously by a different record label, one assumes, and they wanted to get the hit song out, and Elizabeth Welsh, then very young, was chosen as a singer to sing the vocal refrain, and here it is. Great track, by the way. Lovely and fairly unusual and rare track from Elizabeth Welsh right at the beginning of her career. But we're at the end of this podcast. As usual, I'm doing this a couple of months ahead of time. And apart from reminding you, please, to pass on the link to your friends in case you think they might enjoy this wonderful music of yesteryear, just tell them to go and find Earl Oakin's Gramophone Show is the easiest way. I'm doing this when the news here in London has been of these strange riots that have been going on. Of course, it was all kicked off when the police decided to shoot dead somebody who apparently hadn't shot at them, we're now discovering, and as usual, as they tend to do, they started to spread rumours about this man was a gangland boss, and now it seems that he wasn't. I wonder if anybody is sent to jail for that killing. I bet they won't be. There seems to be a different rule for the police than for everybody else. Also, this looting and this robbery, it seems to me to be the result of what happens when you change the morality of the country, as Margaret Thatcher did all those years ago, and nothing has changed since. It's me, me, me. Greed is all right. Take what you can. Of course, this works fine if you happen to be rich, but the ones who aren't so rich and want the same things begin to think they're entitled to things which they're not entitled to, and you end up with this sort of thing. However, let's not get upset about that. I wrote a funny song once, which was really designed to be about bonfire fireworks night, but after the scandal with MPs' expenses just a year or two ago, putting that together with the riots, it seems somehow relevant. So here is my song, and it's called Fireworks in the Commons, and I look forward to seeing you again next time around. Ciao for now.
1605, a guy named Guy with others in the mob. I'll try to blow away the parliament, but someone botched the job. So I went down to hear a big debate, some fine and fancy words. But question time was on this afternoon, and this is what I heard. I'd like to ask the lady why her policy's unstuck, and also just in passing why she waddles like a duck. Her party is divided, her chancellor's in a flap, and all because her mouth's too big, she will not shut her trap. She said, in answer to the question put, I have to disagree. I haven't heard such tripe since August 1953. A gentleman's a pinhead, he's nothing but a yob. The house would be delighted if he'd kindly shut his gob. There was uproar. Fireworks in the Commons. Yeah, someone shouted order, so I thought I'd like a double gin. There was uproar. Fireworks in the Commons. Yeah, I can't believe they let the TV cameras in. A member crossed the chamber and he shouted, this is war. But smiling at the camera, someone socked him on the jaw. Just then a fight broke out without a vote of confidence. For the cabinet all hid behind the Minister of Defense. The speaker from his high chair told them all to take their place. But someone threw an egg and it went smash into his face. The government were losing in this battle of the hordes. Till reinforcement burst right in straight from the House of Lords. There was uproar. Fireworks in the Commons. Yeah. Someone in the gallery started taking bets on who we thought would win. Yeah. Uproar, fireworks in the Commons. Yeah. I can't believe they let the TV cameras in. Now we don't need no gunpowder to sink this heap of stone. Just let these people have their head, they'll do it on their own. Fireworks in the Commons. Take my advice and leave that place alone. Cryptomaniacs.